at a time, where movie props dominate the universe, and prop builders make shit to make the backgrounds look better, welcome to the Prop History Podcast.
Thank you, Greg. Welcome to the Prop History Podcast. My name is Mike.
I'm Greg.
And we have a podcast about props. Well, at least on the surface, that's what it is.
I mean, that's what we say that it is.
Yeah, it's really just us in a shop talking geek stuff shit all the time. Yeah, that's pretty much
it. Yeah, my sister was asking me about this, and she goes, is it Star Wars stuff? I'm like, no. She goes, it's geek stuff, isn't it? I'm like, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's geek stuff. Because that's kind of what we are.
Yeah. Isn't it?
Well, today, Greg, we are going to have a chit-chat about 1999's The Mummy.
So I did something different this time. I actually watched the movie beforehand.
Well, it's funny you say that because Erica and I, Erica's my wife for those who don't know, watched it last night.
Nice.
So it's fresh in my skull.
Yeah, Becky and I watched, my wife, watched it, I think, Wednesday night or Thursday night.
Right. It's a fun movie.
It is. It's a different movie than I remembered it being. You know, in retrospect, but it still holds up really well.
It does. And even there is some like minimal CGI in it. And even that CGI sort of, it sort of works still. Like it's, you can tell it's like late 90s CGI,
so,
but
Becky and I were having this conversation about the CGI because Phantom Menace came out in 1999 too.
I believe it did. Yeah.
And to me, the CGI by and large in the Phantom Menace does not hold up.
New.
And the conversation that we had was that 99% of the Phantom Menace, and I'm making up that statistic, but most of the Phantom Menace was filmed on green screens and blue screens, and whereas the Mummy is very apparently filmed on a soundstage.
Yeah.
So the CGI works in situ, as opposed to everything being CGI.
It's also at the very beginning of the film where it's telling the backstory of Imhotep and all that. Mm-hmm. That very opening scene where it's passing by the city, that's actually a lot of miniature work and matte painting in the background. So it's still that kind of old school miniature matte painting compositing that they were still doing. And then when he's overlooking the city, that's CG. Mm-hmm. But it's the CG is maintained minimal in that, and it's a lot of practical effects, which I love.
Right.
And they still hold up really, really well. Even that minimal CGI still kind of holds up. Still a little wonky in places, but it's still quite good. And then, of course, there's the reason we do this podcast. The props.
The props.
From it.
I was thinking, like, watching this movie, you know, specifically paying attention to the props, and Patricia Velasquez or whatever. that this had to be a prop builder's wet dream.
Yeah.
Like, it's this beautiful combination of raiding prop shops and you know, rental companies. It's building amazing sets and building cool props that didn't exist before.
Yeah. And a lot of it is, I mean, actually, all of the sets are massive in scale in some of them. Because, like, just for, what, the 3 minutes it was on screen, the Pharaoh's bedroom, essentially, all of that was hand-built. They didn't pull anything from old stock, you know. There were a few pieces left over from old movies about Egypt. But for the most part, it was all bespoke for that movie, to be on screen for, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, and that was it.
Well, I'm guessing, though, that, like, the treasure chamber at the end was finding everything that looks Egyptian and gold.
And spray painting it gold. Yeah. Yep. They actually, I think there were several hardware stores in the area around where they were filming, which they filmed it partially in Morocco and partially, I believe, in Elstree. And there were some done in L.A. They were, like, running all of the hardware stores out of gold paint to be able to film that.
Oh, wow.
Because they just were having to spray paint absolutely everything. And it was actually kind of fun that while they were filming in Morocco, they actually had military security. And the director actually took out kidnapping insurance on the main actors and didn't tell them until the filming was done.
I mean, I've been to Morocco, so it's funny. So here's my Morocco story.
Okay.
We were in Tangiers, and we were on a one-day tour, and so we're doing this whirlwind tour through the Casbah, and I decided I wanted to buy a prayer rug. And so I'm at this rug place, and we're negotiating, and my tour group goes off. And the dude that, like, is sticking around, you know, he's like, don't worry, I get you back to, you know, the tour group. Or whatever his Moroccan accent was that I did poorly. And so, you know, I buy this rug, and we're walking to try to catch up with the rest of the group. And he's like, this way, this way, this way. And I had a panic attack. Like, I'm like, this is how I'm going to die. I'm like, stop, hold on. And he's like, dude, this is not Detroit. I'm like, okay, I'm good. Let's go.
Dude, this is not Detroit. Well, did you know that the Mummy from 1999 with Brendan Fraser, that's a remake?
From the original, like, Boris Karloff.
1932 film. Yeah. And do you know what that's based on?
No.
So, right when they made the movie in 1932, The Mummy, with Boris Karloff, there was a big kind of thing going on where they had recently opened King Tut's tomb, and everybody was clamoring to make a movie about it. And they couldn't really find a story to base it on, like to adapt.
Yeah.
So they went with one about a 3,000-year-old magician that uses sulfates to stay alive, because science back then was...
Sure.
No one cared.
Sure.
The Cagliostro. The story of Cagliostro was what they adapted into The Mummy.
Huh.
And then... of course, they remade it again in 1999, and then, of course, they remade it again.
No, they didn't. No, they didn't stop. Just don't say that. Just end that thought.
So there was a movie made that has to do with mummies, with what's his name in it? He hangs off the side of planes. Tom Cruise. Yeah, Maverick from Top Gun in that, and they actually have one of the books from 1999's The Mummy in it. It's the Book of Amun-Ra, the gold one.
I'm critical of it. I haven't seen it, but I heard it didn't do well and wasn't made well, and I just don't know what to do with Tom Cruise anymore.
I watched it. I'm not proud of that, but I watched it. It was if you did not try to connect it to anything and you sat back and just watched it for what it is, it's... I don't like being critical of movies, but it felt off. Like, the pacing was bad, and it just felt like they kind of threw it together. Russell Crowe was awesome, but Russell Crowe's always awesome. So,
Javert.
Mm-hmm. Except when he's throwing phones at people.
I try to be the guy that likes things.
Yeah.
You know, like, I've only walked out of one movie once, and that was because I was young. Like, I walked out of Basic Instinct because I was like 15. You know, like, I didn't get it. You know, now I get it, but,
yeah.
I I've seen Top Gun probably 300 plus times, and I love it. But I also absolutely love Iron Eagle. So, yeah. Which is, you know, like the stupid version of Top Gun.
Right. It's really kind of a hokey movie, but I enjoy both of them for what they are.
Yeah.
Because I'm a fan of aviation anyway.
Sure.
And the cinematography in Top Gun is awesome. I'm looking forward to the new Top Gun only because of the cinematography that they're going to do with the aircraft.
You know, more people died filming Top Gun than have ever died as a participant in the Top Gun program.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, as I know, one of the aircraft they were using went into the ground.
Yeah, the I forget his name because names escape me. But if we weren't recording, I could tell you. But yeah, the pilot who did the cinematography crashed his plane and died. But nobody's actually ever died in Top Gun.
Huh? They have a perfect safety record.
Apparently,
that's cool. The Mummy, 1999.
Listen, folks, if you wanted us to be linear, you picked the wrong podcast.
Yeah, this is not the right podcast for that. So, you watched The Mummy recently.
I did.
I watched The Mummy recently.
You did.
What, in your opinion, stands out as the best prop from that movie?
It's got to be the books. Mm-hmm. Like, and specifically the Book of the Dead. Like, the Book of the Living is beautiful because it's gold and it's so similar to the Book of the Dead, but... The Book of the Dead is just gorgeous. Like,
the Book of the Dead is amazing. And in fact, the screen used one just went up for sale on Prop Store not too long ago.
Do you know what that sold for?
I believe it was like $330,000.
Just out of my price range.
Right? I could have bought, you know, at that price, buy two. Why not?
Yeah.
Because they also sold the stunt Book of Amun-Ra, which is the gold one. And they actually, I'm trying to remember, there was one of the keys, I think, was in that sale as well. But now someone has the actual Book of the Dead, so they can raise Imhotep. And a lot of people
don't do it.
Now, the Book of Amun-Ra, the gold one, is kind of interesting. It's barely seen on screen. It's never on there for very long. But it actually opens the opposite way of the Book of the Dead. So the Book of the Dead opens like a normal book does, like you would any English book written in English. It opens that way. The Book of Amun-Ra opens the other direction because they're opposites in every way, which is kind of cool. But
I never noticed that.
But they never touch on it. You know, they barely show. They only show the one scene where Evie opens it while her brother holds the book.
Yeah,
and she's opening it in the opposite way. Now, unless they flipped the footage for some reason, that's how it is. Now, I've never actually seen either of the books, the actual screen use books up close. I own a casting of the stunt Book of the Dead.
I bet they flipped the thing.
Or did they?
Or she's just reading it upside down, and I bet he opens it the right way. She's standing in front of him reading upside down, and because she really doesn't read hieroglyphics.
Yeah, nobody cared.
Right.
Or if it was done just to make the scene look good, because if she opens the book the normal way, it would block the camera
as
it came up. So that way, who knows?
So I had a question, and not prop related, but a linguistics question, is that I understand that people can read hieroglyphics, but would they know what those hieroglyphics would have made?
I seem to remember reading that because of the Rosetta Stone, we know what they say.
Right.
But we don't necessarily know what it sounds like.
So like when is Imhotep?
Yeah.
When he's talking and Benny's translating for him, like how would he know what he's saying? Because like nobody's spoken that language. Or
I know in some parts of it he's speaking Hebrew, when he's speaking. I don't know if that's modern, like a modern iteration of Egyptian, or if it's an accepted pronunciation. But I don't know, and I think it's probably just going to be suspension of disbelief kind of stuff here.
And that's, I mean, eventually where I got. But you know, nobody would understand Chaucer if Chaucer was talking today.
No, like the old English of that period, like he would be nearly unintelligible today. So I think that's the issue, is that we don't necessarily know what ancient Egyptian sounded like. And we know what it says, but we don't know how it was pronounced specifically. And there's probably a lot of, like every language, a lot of slang in it that we wouldn't know, and that sort of thing. So I don't know. Maybe it's probably just one of those suspension of disbelief things we have to do.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny what you get caught up on. It's like, nobody would understand that, but there's a walking mummy. Okay.
Yeah, we're worried about the language, and there's a mummy. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah. And then because I have the Book of the Dead, and because I have, right now I have two of the Canopic jars, which are made by an Italian artist, J.C. Porcel on the RPF. He's made two so far, and I think he's slowly working on the rest of them. That box that they pull out from underneath the statue of Anubis, I think, I really want to build that box to display all of it in when I have it. But there's very few images of it, sadly. And I want the sword he fights with.
Yeah.
Oh. Which sold not too long ago as well, a couple years ago, I think.
So I used to own the Studio Master that all of the Magi swords were made off of.
And you got rid of it.
I did. I actually know where it is. I could probably get it back. But
can you?
Yeah, probably. So
I want one.
If nothing else, I'm sure I can borrow it so you could mold it.
Well, I would do that in a heartbeat. So I would make a new mold or at least cast it.
I don't know if I have a picture of it, but it's the...
This will translate well on a podcast.
All right. Well, I was going to show you.
Right.
But yeah, it was originally CNC'd out of wood, and then they would have molded it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bought it from the Prop Store of London, our unofficial sponsor.
Right.
Back in the day. And... see if I can. It's not this.
If we keep mentioning Prop Store, they'll either sponsor us or send us a C&D. One of the two.
So it's this sword.
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
Yep. So, see, it's this sword.
Yeah, he's showing the microphone. I'm glad you all could see that.
But they made that sword out of wood. If you go online and just type in Magi sword, the mummy, it's not the. The curve, it's curved, but it's got the hilt goes all the way across. as opposed to not. But there are definitely images if you want to see what I'm talking about. But yeah, they made that out of wood, and it was, I'm pretty sure it was CNC'd out of just like MDF or something. And it might have been an actual hardwood. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I bought that, and my plan was to mold it and make castings of it. And this is going to be noisy, I'm sorry. Nobody was interested, so I just didn't bother wasting the rubber.
Now, was the Hero, was it metal? I imagine the Hero was metal.
Probably. Yeah,
because they usually do that. They usually make a Hero.
So
I don't know. What I do know is that I have all of the pages made now.
Oh, nice.
For the interior of the book. Because like, the stunt copy that I have is hollow.
Right.
Because it's just a stunt. It was rubber initially. Mine's resin, but... And I have all the pages, and a fellow that I have been speaking to online, he has had access to the Hero Book of the Dead before it got sold, and he took a bunch of pictures of the lock and how it works. So hopefully by the end of the year, I'll have working replicas of those.
Those pages are, what, quarter inch thick, maybe?
Just about, yeah.
So...
And it's the exact same pages in the Book of the Dead as in the Book of Amun-Ra. They're just in a different order.
Fascinating.
Because they only made four
pages. You know I could laser cut that, right?
I already did.
Did you?
I laser cut a nail. They're over there in that cabinet over there that's missing its door because I pulled it off this morning by accident.
Nice.
Yeah. I have, yeah, hopefully by the end of the year I'll have those ready. And I'm planned to make a master set out of aluminum.
That would be awesome. And then
use those to make molds.
Sounds stupid expensive.
Oh, it's going to be. It's going to be ridiculously expensive, but I don't care.
That's just funny.
I really want working Book of the Dead, Book of Amun-Ra. So that I can say that I have them and then make resin casts for people to buy.
So I had a kit of the one you have, mm-hmm. and it was, there was some wonkiness to it that I kept wanting to fix, and then I lost the kit, so.
Was that Adam Attis kit from the RPF, or?
That's 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how long he's had those molds. It might be his still. So. Because he's the only one that had them.
Yeah.
Because he owned the original production molds.
Oh, wow.
And he made 8 copies of them.
I want to say, like, the name that it was under back then was, like, Waco Props or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say it was out of Texas.
I mean, it's entirely plausible that it's the same guy or they're the same molds or...
Yeah. They look the same, but, yeah. You know, I mean, if they're doing it right, then they should look the same, I guess.
I suppose. But I have not ever seen any molds... or copies or castings or anything of the Book of Amun-Ra. Hmm. I mean, there's handmade ones out there, but I've never seen anybody that has a copy of it. And I wonder, did they make stunt copies of that? They had to have, because the heroes weigh a ton. So I'm guessing there's molds out there. Now I need to find out if they exist, because now I want the Book of Amun-Ra.
Yeah.
If anybody out there is listening, all 9 of you, that knows anything about molds, the Book of Amun-Ra, let me know, please.
Yeah, I mean, the hard part about that is going to be the vac metalizing to, mm-hmm. you know, but... Yeah.
But still, worth a shot.
Sure.
Yeah, never know until you try. What other props from the mummy?
You know, the key is cool, but it... So I've owned resin castings of that key for so long that I'm kind of blasé about it.
You're actually sitting next to molds for that key, as a matter of fact, right over there.
I'm holding the scarab... right now. I've always, and you did a small version of this, but I have always wanted to make the whole wall mm-hmm. full of scarabs that you could just pop off.
Yeah, that the warden pops one off and it eats into his foot and eats his brain eventually.
And then
yeah.
it runs into a wall.
I'm really shocked at how many people... yeah. I'm really shocked at how many people were super upset by that scene. And it actually terrified a lot of folks because... Really? Well, as a lot of people have phobias about... bugs anyway, and now here they're presented with one where it's going to eat into their foot and into their brain, so that just sets off all kinds of triggers. And I've actually gotten a lot of comments about it and stuff that I've posted on TikTok about it that terrified me
really
for forever. But what most people don't realize is that the scarabs are dung beetles. They were very much a part of Egyptian culture, huh. and they were considered an aspect of the god of rebirth, whose name I can't remember right now. And in fact, with a lot of mummies, when they actually pull up that haven't been had their tombs disturbed, sometimes they'll have the symbol of that over their heart as a symbol of rebirth. They'll have a scarab over it, and that's what it's associated with, is rebirth. So, that to my knowledge, there were never any scarabs that were horrifying meat eaters that will dig into your skin. And in fact, the Book of the Dead is based on something that existed in real life too. And the Book of the Dead was actually a papyrus scroll. There's several that still exist to this day that were sort of codes of conduct for the afterlife and gave you instructions about all the tests you would have to pass to get into the afterlife.
Dude, I got to study to die.
Essentially, yes. Well, I mean, you look back at ancient Egyptian culture and death was a big business. I mean, it was a huge industry in ancient Egypt. And like one of the tests that a lot of people know about, maybe indirectly, because it's been shown in pop culture a whole lot, is that you'd have your heart weighed against a feather to be able to get in. And like Osiris would ask you all these questions and then they would weigh your heart against a feather. And if your heart weighed more than the feather, then a three-headed dog came out and ate you and you ceased to exist. Egyptian afterlife is metal, is what I'm trying to say.
I just saw Fluffy from Harry Potter coming out.
Just eating your soul.
I see you met my dog Fluffy.
Yep, Hagrid comes out of nowhere in Egyptian afterlife. I want Hagrid to be an ancient Egyptian god now. My apologies if I'm insulting anyone's religious beliefs.
I mean, you have to understand that Mike and I are exceptionally woke, but sometimes things are just...
Yeah, sometimes things are just funny for the dumbest reasons, and we can always edit this out, but we probably won't. So you're going to be forced to hear this. Now, who's your favorite character from The Mummy?
Wow, I don't know if I've ever contemplated that. You know, I like the actors as individuals in this movie so much. Eric Avari, who plays the guy at the museum. I don't know what his character
is. Dr. Terrence Bay is his name.
Dr. Bay. Is your phone going off?
That's your phone, bud.
No, I've turned... Is it?
Yeah.
I have mine on
or
mute.
Or is it mine?
It's yours, dude.
Oh, it's mine. I'm the jerk here. Sorry.
Put your phone on mute.
Don't tell me what to do. You're not my real dad.
Your real dad left you. I'm all you got.
Technically, my real dad's dead.
Your dad's dead. I'm all you've got.
No. Fine. Whatever. But Eric Avari.
I haven't gotten to meet him, but he has been on the convention circuit, you know, off and on for years. And I just hear nothing but wonderful stories about him. And he seems absolutely awesome.
Odette Fair.
Fair. Mm-hmm. Who is now on Star Trek Discovery as Admiral Vance, I think it is. He is so good.
Yeah.
You know,
everything about his character is awesome.
Yeah.
And my wife was telling me yesterday that when she first saw the movie, everybody was going goo goo over Brendan Fraser, because this is right after George of the Jungle.
Right.
And of course...
And Encino Man.
And how well George of the Jungle did was actually why he got cast. Because initially they approached Brad Pitt about
It would be a
completely different movie. But he just wouldn't fit. They also approached Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, which could you imagine how... How the movie would change. But they looked at Brendan Fraser and they're like, you could pull off that Errol Flynn... esque thing that they wanted, because it was very, this movie is very much like the 1930s swashbuckler kind of films in its own way. But they approached him about it, and I forget where I was going with this, but my wife, Brendan Fraser, everybody's going Google over him because he's an extremely attractive man.
Sure.
And then she watched the movie and she saw Odette Fair and was like, hello, and decided that he was for her. So, and I'm totally cool with that. But I mean, dude was hot, straight up. That's just how it is.
It's the smoky eyes.
It's the smoky eyes. They actually intended initially, because he's got the tattoos there underneath his eyes, that they were going to cover his entire face with tattoos, and that all of the Magi were going to have all these tattoos all over their face. And the director actually looked at him and said, no, he's too pretty to be covered in tattoos. We're going to just leave these.
That was a good call.
It was a good choice. And I have to say that I love all the characters in this individually for what they are, but Winston Havelock.
Oh, my
Captain
God.
Winston Havelock, played by Bernard Fox. Everything stinking of boredom and booze. That guy. I love his character because of just how batty he is.
You're probably going
to
die.
Yeah, and that's all he wants. He just wants to die to join his buddies from the First War.
I looked up what that plane was, and then I forgot what it is.
It's a de Havilland Tiger Moth. It's a pre-World War II light trainer used by the Royal Air Force.
See, when I looked it up, it was something... They said something totally different, because I thought it was a Sopwith Camel. So...
I'm pretty sure that that's a de Havilland Tiger Moth. No, I'm going to look it up, because I question myself. Unless it's the German trainer, which I don't think it is.
This is what we're doing.
Yeah, this is how we do things. This is really riveting.
So
stuff.
This says that it was a Bristol F2 fighter.
No, the Brisfits is what that was called initially. There, I don't think there's but one or two flying. I think that's what
that
it was.
Didn't fly.
I think that's what it was supposed to be.
Gotcha.
But I'm looking up. Yeah, it's a de Havilland Tiger Moth is what it is.
Okay. I trust you.
And it had a gunner's position in the back that was added. And that gun that he's actually using is a Lewis gun, the one that Oded Furrer pulls off. And it's actually the Japanese export version, a Japanese designed version of the Lewis gun that was made on license by the Japanese government after World War One. And at that time, it was actually the only one in the world that fired.
Huh.
And it was owned by a Hollywood prop house, an armorer's house, which I think is kind of a cool little feature of it.
So you had to be just like going crazy watching this with all the guns.
All the amazing guns. Because like the two revolvers that he carries are these French Delavigne double action revolvers, which I've never seen in a movie before. And they're period correct. And this is another thing that The Mummy gets right. A lot of the guns, in fact, almost every single gun in that movie is period correct. The rifles that the French Foreign Legion are carrying, they're 1885 Lebels, which would be correct. I don't know that those rifles were in service by the late 1920s, but they may very well have been. They served in a lot of armies for a long time. Like even the Tuaregs, the guys that attack them at Hamanoptera, all of their rifles are period correct. It's very rare for a movie to get all the guns period correct.
Yeah.
And of course he's carrying a pair of 1911s because he has the double New York reload during that scene where he just drops his Delavines and then goes to the 1911s. His shotgun is period correct. All of the pistols that the Americans are carrying are period correct. So it's really interesting to see that. And the other fun thing that they get right is round count. In almost every scene, the amount of bullets that would be in those specific guns, that's how many they fire. There's only a couple times that they break that rule, but their round count is pretty accurate throughout the movie, which is kind of fun as well.
Now, the one scene with the Uzi and the banana clip, that really just...
What?
Oh, wait.
That's not in that movie.
That was Cobra with Stallone.
Oh, yeah, that movie. Yeah. We'll pretend that didn't happen. The movie's dreadful. Oh, goodness.
Yeah, no, but as I was watching it, especially when he rolls out of his bag of tricks.
Yeah.
I'm just like, yeah, Mike's going crazy.
Oh, no, it saddens me because that equipment roll that he has, whatever that thing, it was bespoke, it was made specifically for the movie, that went up for sale on Prop Store, and I was very close to purchasing it. Like, I got outbid. Like, it just went past where I could by just a little bit. And it was so close to owning it. No, I was so mad.
But see, here's the thing about that line of thinking is, like, you're like, oh, if I had bid $5 more, I would have won it. No, they would have bid $5 more,
no,
and then it would have been $1,000 more.
Yeah, so. I think it ended up selling for right around $8,500.
Oh, wow.
And it was empty. It had nothing in it. Just the roll, yeah.
Wow.
But they only made the one, so it was the hero,
cool.
The hero prop and all that. And I really wanted it because I wanted to, because I own a Delavigne.
Oh, nice.
And I wanted to, I have the opportunity to make copies of it and all that. And I wanted to do that whole equipment roll.
Oh, sure.
All, you know, obviously fakes of all the weapons and all that stuff just to have as a display.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I wasn't able to get it. It makes me mad.
I'm sorry. So well, one of these days, you know, if you guys aren't following him on TikTok, he's blowing up.
For real.
Props to history on TikTok.
Mm-hmm.
Check out Mike there. But you're blowing up there, so one of these days you're going to just become famous and rich, and you can buy it from whoever bought it.
I know. That's what I'm hoping. That's really, if anyone is listening to this podcast that came here from TikTok, thank you very much for that. Also, if anyone is on TikTok, there is a link on my bio to go and sign a petition to get me a TV show. And I'm only doing this to show audience interest because that is not how anything works. But it just shows audience
interest. This is not how that works.
Right?
This isn't how any of this works.
So this podcast is actually being recorded on the 13th of February. And I have like 70,000 some subscribe followers on TikTok.
My anniversary, by the way.
Oh, happy anniversary. Thank you. What are you doing here on your anniversary?
Because she's asleep. I'm letting her sleep in. That's one of my anniversary gifts to her, is not waking her up and letting her sleep.
That is a sound thing to do.
I thought so.
And by the time this airs, which will be 2 weeks from today, actually almost 2 weeks today, because it'll air on Friday, I'd be curious to see where I'm at. Followers wise, well, or if I've just been banned, I don't know.
So when I got here, like 45 minutes ago, you were at 68,700 followers, mm-hmm. and now you are at 69,400 followers.
Oh dear!
So
it's insane. I love it. I absolutely love it.
Near, what is that, 700 new followers in the last 40 minutes?
Yeah, I actually gained 13,000 last night.
What the hell what drove that?
So I did a video on what happened to the ship, the Inferno, that was made for Goonies.
Yeah.
Like its ultimate fate, because people asked me what happened to it. And of course, after filming was done, they did the Cyndi Lauper video from the soundtrack, and then they dismantled it because nobody wanted it. They didn't have a use for it. It was built in a soundstage, and that soundstage needed to be used for other stuff, so they had to get rid of it. And part of it was destroyed, and the rest of it went to a landfill.
So we were talking, and we'll do it. Let's do the next one on Goonies.
Yeah, we'll do the next one on Goonies.
But we were talking a little earlier about this, and it turns out a friend of mine was the one of the lead model makers for Goonies.
So. We should see if he wants to call in.
Yeah, I can ask him.
Yeah, because that would be really cool to have him have his direct perspective of particularly the model maker side of the Goonies.
Yeah, no, that would be awesome.
Because he'd be the first guest ever on our podcast, which is not anything to brag about, but...
It could... I mean, it's not like he needs us to help with his career.
No, he has an Oscar. He doesn't need us for anything.
Yeah, no.
we have to beg him?
I'll buy you Girl Scout cookies.
I'll have my wife send him brownies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wife's an... Awesome. Not Becky's like, will you bring something home? I'm like, I'm not asking.
All you had to do was say something and she would have baked something. She's been desperate to make lemon bars here recently. This is a podcast about the mummy.
Again, if you wanted us to do this linear.
Yeah, this is the wrong podcast.
Yeah.
This is the wrong podcast.
I really, so watching The Mummy again for probably the first time in years, mm-hmm. I was really happy that it was still good. I felt like, and I don't know if this is a chicken or the egg thing, I felt like it was a ride at an amusement park. And I don't know if felt like a ride at an amusement park because it was modeled after rides at an amusement park, or this was the movie that changed how we do rides at amusement parks.
It reminded me a lot, the feeling I got when I watched Pirates of the Caribbean, the first one, for the first time. It's you're right. It felt like an amusement park ride a little bit. And I think it kind of became the archetype of that sort of adventure film in that era of, this is how you do just a fun, goofy adventure film that doesn't take itself very seriously. Because it doesn't. It makes jokes at itself all the time.
Yeah.
But I have to agree, it's very much that feeling that, like, this is an exciting adventure that I don't have to think too much about. And I rather like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, I felt like I could have been on a small roller coaster, feeling the ups and the downs, mm-hmm. and like when Winston crashes the plane into the sand, and like I'm looking over to the left and there's this scene, and over to the right is this scene.
Right.
Except that's my left and that's my right.
It doesn't matter.
They don't know. it was fun. It was, even the bad characters were fun.
Yeah, and I love that the character Benny, played by Kevin O'Connor, there's a little fun little bit of trivia that all of the camels legitimately hated him on set.
That's
like,
funny.
Like when he's trying, at the end of the movie, when he's got all the gold on one and he's trying to pull it, that wasn't the camel being trained to do that. That was because that camel hated his guts. Like it tried to bite him several times. It just really, all of the camels apparently really hated Benny.
Wasn't he in The Green Mile? Is that what he also did?
No, he was in... I'm trying to remember all the different movies he was in. He was in a movie with Scott Bakula, The Illusionist, I think. He's been a character actor in a bunch of different movies, like usually a background actor, background character. And I'm trying to remember some of the other stuff he's been in. There's Kevin J. O'Connor. Yeah. You know what? If only I had a device with which to look things up at the speed of light.
Oh my God! Right.
He was in. Let's see. His first movie was One More Saturday Night. He was in Peggy Sue Got Married.
Oh, that's right. That's. I think that's what stands out because he was the guy that he helped her go back in time.
Mm-hmm. Canadian Bacon, which I love that movie. Virtuosity, Lord of Illusions is the thing. I'm thinking of with Scott Bakula. He was in Amistad. I didn't know that. Deep Rising with Treat Williams, The Mummy. He was in Van Helsing. G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra. Wish Upon a Unicorn. Never seen that, but he was in it.
I know that that Jonathan Hyde was the butler in Richie Rich movie.
He was, yeah.
That's what I'll always remember him for. Oh, he was also the dad in Jumanji. He was Alan...
That was the Egyptologist that was the dad in Jumanji. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kevin O'Connor was Benny.
The sniveling
little character.
Jonathan Hyde, though.
Yeah, Dr. Alan Chamberlain in The Mummy.
Yeah, but he was the dad in Jumanji. He was in...
That's another movie we need to do a podcast about.
Oh, my God, I love Jumanji. Yeah.
Mm, that movie is so good. And I'm really surprised. I was not expecting a whole lot from the remakes. Have you seen any of the remakes?
Oh, yeah, I love them.
They're super fun.
And the second one, or the first remake, the second of the three movies,
right,
did a great tribute to Alan's character in that.
Because he always does in the remakes, Jack Black completely steals everything.
Yeah,
steals the show with his character. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, if you haven't seen the new Jumanji films, by all means, please watch them. They're a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah,
and they really don't take themselves seriously at all, which is great.
Yeah, We'll just have to talk about it.
We keep going to different movies, but it doesn't matter because it's our podcast. We do what we want,
right?
You're the ones that are still listening.
Here's the thing: when you watch a movie, there's an emotional investment you have to the actors because of other stuff they've done.
Yeah,
right. Like we were talking about Brendan Fraser got this gig because of George of the Jungle, and. Like you have these emotional connections to these actors because that you like something else they did,
right?
And
that's just how it goes. Now, speaking of The Mummy, and we talked a little bit about the CGI and how it still works. Let's talk about the second Mummy and how the CGI didn't work.
I've probably seen the original Mummy 15 times, mm-hmm. and I think I've only seen the second one once.
So we're of course talking about Mummy 2, and I believe it was subtitled The Curse of the Scorpion King, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Was that the one with The Rock?
Yeah, that was the one with The Rock. So it had some cool props in it, like the bracelet was amazing. That thing was great.
That was a big thing on the RPF for a while.
Yeah, there was a run. I can't remember who did it now, but they did a beautiful job of remaking it and its chest that it was found in. I liked that movie. I even liked it because, despite the fact that it had some of the worst CGI in film history, but I enjoyed it for what it was. I thought it was fun.
I can't really speak on it because I saw it once and I didn't, it just didn't stand out in my head a whole lot.
It doesn't work well anymore because it is, it's hard to get past that really bad CGI that's in it. And it feels like they did the whole movie and they got to the end with the scenes with the Scorpion King in it. And they were just like, well, we're out of money. Do what we can do.
Oh, yeah. And hey, is your 8-year-old for sale?
Essentially.
Oh, yeah. When he becomes the Scorpion.
Yeah, when he becomes the Scorpion thing.
I had forgot how bad that was.
I wish that initially their plan was to just have him come out as The Rock and beat the crap out of Brendan Fraser. And, that would have been fine. I'd have been okay with that. If he'd come out and beat the crap out of Brendan Fraser and then probably beat the crap out of Imhotep.
You know, smell what I'm cooking?
Yeah. He didn't even have to say anything. He didn't have any lines in the movie anyway, but I think that would have been more fun if they'd done it that way. And then, of course, there's Mummy 3, which takes place in China.
I've never even seen that one.
Yeah, it takes place in China post-World War II. And they allude that Brendan Fraser's character and the actor for Evie had changed because of a scheduling conflict with Rachel Wise, that they were OSS agents a la Indiana Jones. How he worked with the Office of Strategic Services, the precursor to the MI6 and CIA during the Second World War. and that they fought against the Nazis and all this other stuff. But it was fun in and of itself, too. And, of course, it stars Jet Li as the main bad guy.
Was it worth watching?
Honestly, I think it is. I mean, you have to get past a few goofy-ass things in it, but for the most part, it was really enjoyable.
So,
but I'm biased because I really, really like The Mummy and all of them.
Well, I love the first one. I was in a very transitional part of life when that came out, so probably wouldn't have been.
There's also a lot of flamethrowers in the second Mummy.
Oh, well, you know.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, especially.
Another movie that uses liquid fuel flamethrowers.
Right.
Because we talked about that our last podcast.
Mummy, The Thing.
The Thing. And what the hell was the other movie? What did we do about Alien?
Alien.
The one we did a podcast about.
It's really hard to keep track of all.
It is. You know what? We've gotten knowledge from so many movies jammed in our heads. It's easy to cross them up a bunch of times. But
and I'm super ADD, so that doesn't.
Oh yeah, no, I bounce all over the place. But just look at the state of my shop. It's terrible.
No, it's better than mine. Mine's a total mess right now.
Well, this one's half a mess.
Well, yours is like a quarter the size of mine.
It's super small. But. We are now at the 41-minute mark,
so I
think we could probably wrap this up and bring it to a close. Is there anything you want to plug, bud?
Well, our unofficial sponsor, Prop Store London. check out Mike's TikTok at Props to History. And I don't know. What about you?
Well, I am now Instagram.com/props to history. I've swapped over entirely. I'm kind of transitioning away from Mike's Tiny Shop at this point. And it is TikTok at Props to History. And you can check out Greg on Instagram at, where is it at, Greg?
It's just greg.nowling, greg.nowling.
This has been the Prop History Podcast. Thank you very much for listening.
Bye.